This is Macro Voices, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Macro Voices episode 415 was produced on February 15th, 2024. I'm Eric Townsend. Variant Perception CEO and Chief Market Strategist Tian Yang returns as this week's feature interview guest. Tian prepared a terrific slide deck full of charts, and we'll talk through most asset classes and the trading opportunities Tian sees in them. The X Spaces interview hosted by our friend Dr. Anas Alhaji that I announced last week didn't happen as planned, due to one participant having a personal emergency, not to mention the fact that it would have been in competition with the Super Bowl. That Spaces has been rescheduled to 2 p.m. Eastern Time on Sunday, February 18th. The topic is the nuclear renaissance and where it's headed. I'll be a panelist alongside Uranium Insider newsletter publisher Justin Hune and Copenhagen Atomics founder Thomas Jam Peterson. Follow at Anas Alhaji, that's A-N-A-S-A-L-H-A-J-J-I, on X to be notified of when this Spaces session begins. It's also linked in your Research Roundup email.
And I'm Patrick Ceresna with the Macro Scoreboard week over week. As of the close of Wednesday, February 14th, 2024, the S&P 500 March futures were up 6 basis points, trading at 5,018. Some OPEX gamma pinning occurring, but the market is shaping up for some volatility in the weeks to come. We'll take a closer look at that chart and the key technical levels to watch in the post-game segment. The U.S. dollar index up 63 basis points, trading to 104.71. The U.S. dollar continues to show strength since putting in a low at the start of the year. WTI crude oil up 376 basis points, trading at 76.64. It's bouncing around a three-month range. We'll take a look at that chart in the postgame, and Eric will have the EIA inventory data. The RBOB gasoline up 265 basis points, trading at 232. Gold down 229 basis points, trading at 2004. Breakdown below the January lows. Copper down 80 basis points to 370. Uranium down 63 basis points, trading at 102.25, and the U.S. 10-year Treasury yield up 14 basis points, trading at 4.26. It is a significant breakout after bottoming in the prior 2 months. The key news to watch this week is the PPI inflation number and the University of Michigan consumer sentiment. And next week, we have the FOMC meeting minutes and a series of global flash manufacturing and services PMIs. This week's feature interview guest is Variant Perception CEO Tian Yang. Eric, why did we invite Tian back on the show this week?
Variant Perception has been very popular with our listeners, and they've made some brilliant calls. Particularly last time we had Tian on the show, he made an excellent call on gold topping using one of their indicators, and so we thought we were overdue for an update.
Well, Eric's interview with Tian Yang is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
And now, with this week's special guest, here's your host, Eric Townsend.
Joining me now is Tian Yang, CEO and Head of Research for Variant Perception. Tian prepared a slide deck, which everybody's going to want to download. Variant Perception is very well known for their excellent graphs and charts. Registered users will find the download link in your Research Roundup email. If you don't have a Research Roundup email, it means you're not yet registered at macrovoices.com. Just go to our homepage, macrovoices.com, click the red button above Tian's picture that says looking for the downloads. Tian, I got to compliment you. The last time that we had you on the show, you mentioned one of the leading indicators, which your firm is particularly well known for, called LPPL. And I'm going to have you explain what that means in just a second. At that time, you said the LPPL indicator was flashing a top, or at least a short-term top, on the gold market. You called it to the day, and we saw the market trade off substantially from there. Tell us a little bit more, just so we can understand this, how that indicator works, and is that same indicator flashing any signals on, I don't know if it's gold or any other markets right now?
Yeah, well, first of all, thanks for having me back. Always glad to be on Macro Voices. regarding LPPL, it stands for log periodic power law. And to us, it's a better model to figure out the end of a trend compared to kind of more standard things people might use, such as looking at RSIs or looking at deviation from moving averages. Essentially, the marginal edge you get with LPPL is that it captures the underlying wave of the market and not just kind of the parabolic price move. So in a way, you not just get a parabolic price move, but there's this kind of extra condition to understand that the market is behaving a disorderly pattern where essentially the price action speeds up as it exhausts. So to us, this is a kind of typical trading pattern you see towards the end of a lot of fairly major trends. And typically the risk reward for a fade is usually quite good. Now, we didn't obviously come up with the idea all by ourselves. You know, Didier Sonnet is kind of considered the, I guess, you know, the godfather of our LPPL and popularizing. I think we've just tried to make him a lot more practical and actionable, you know, get the models running, you know, on a daily intraday basis. So yeah, obviously if people are interested to find out more, you know, a quick Google will work. But in terms of live today, I think, well, even just literally before we got on, we got an LPPL crash climax on Palladium. So it feels like maybe this is finally time. I mean, it's been a pretty mega downtrend, many full storms. It's also kind of interesting because the linkages to kind of South Africa and South African equity has also been extremely bummed out. Years of kind of foreigners withdrawing money. So I think Palladium is potentially a very interesting one for a tactical bounce. The other one, which is probably not going to be that surprising to listeners, is China has had multiple LPPL crash climaxes in essentially the last few weeks on various China-linked equities. So on that, the one thing I would say is that obviously with a lot of the structural problems in China, you know, I think most investors are probably wised up to the fact that a lot of these things are sort of features and not bugs of investing Chinese assets. But nevertheless, there's going to be very interesting kind of trade structures you can put around it, you know, 1x2 call spreads on things like Hang Seng. You know, there's a lot of these kind of very cute trade structures where you can cap your downside and get the exposure, you know, if we get that squeeze. So, you know, those are kind of a couple of kind of live trading signals that it's generating right now.
Let's move on to the slide deck. Unusual title, Fiscal Sisyphus or Hercules? What are we talking about here?
So I think we wanted to really put into context just how extreme the fiscal deficit and the fiscal impact of the U.S. government policy has been. So the kind of story of Sisyphus is this idea of him rolling the boulder up the hill, you know, condemned by the gods to keep rolling. And it, obviously, if he stops, then the boulder tends to roll downhill. And to us, that's a pretty interesting analogy for where we are, where, you know, it's extremely rare in the history of the U.S. state to have such large fiscal deficits whilst U.S. households actually drawing down savings as well. So the U.S. government has really done a big job boosting growth, boosting the economy. And there's an element of, you know, when we dig under the hood on the data, you know, in terms of which sectors are creating jobs and so forth, that there seems to be a decent amount of dependence on the U.S. government carrying this on this year as well. So that's why we thought it'd be quite a nice visual to just describe how meaningful the fiscal impulse and the fiscal deficits have been, but also just the dependence we have on that right now.
Tian, let's move on to page 4, tax receipts. What's the story here?
Yeah, so I think we wanted to flag that, you know, there's a lot of weird things in the data that we've been trying to figure out the underlying rationale to explain. And in a way, the sheer amount of weird divergences right now speaks to just how unprecedented an environment we're living in today. Particularly, what's been very interesting is that we see divergences between U.S. government tax receipts and just things like nominal GDP. And these divergences are still kind of hold even when you break the data down. So, you know, it's pretty rare for taxes, nominal taxes on production to be, you know, not growing whilst nominal GDP is super strong. Like historically, these series are extremely well correlated. Similarly, you know, personal tax receipts in the U.S. have also been extremely, well, actually they've been falling, which again is very rare outside of recessions. So we wanted to dig into the rationales, and I think there's various explanations for these, such as COVID enabling kind of tax avoidance with people setting up small businesses, and, you know, things around the kind of IRA, Inflation Reduction Act, tax credits, and so forth. So, you know, essentially putting it together, it looks like maybe even the government ran a bigger deficit than they intended last year because of these various loopholes and shifts under the hood. So there's a risk that this year it might be hard to keep the same rate of fiscal stimulus, but you know, that's the reason to keep an eye on the data. And as of right now, we're still kind of going along at the same kind of 6 to 7% of GDP deficit run rate as last year. But I think that's one thing that when we looked under the hood in the data, we're somewhat concerned about and we're tracking.
Tian, let's move on to page 5. Job opening data is worse than headline, distorted by labor hoarding.
Yeah, so there's this a really interesting divergence under the hood in the U.S. labor market data. So I think it's felt to us a little bit like there's a bit of a paradox going on with the labor data, where again, the aggregate headline numbers, you know, you look at non-farm payrolls, initial claims, you know, those numbers all look very strong still. Yet there's a lot more stories about companies doing layoffs, doing hiring freezes. And it turns out if you take the data and break it down by micro businesses versus other businesses, you can kind of get a much clearer picture of what's going on. So for these micro businesses, you know, which we defined as less than 10 employees, they're the ones that were most affected by COVID. So out of COVID, they weren't really able to improve their hiring, but they massively raised the amount of job openings. So essentially, there's like a million extra job openings resulting from these micro businesses. And yet, if you take all the other businesses with more than 10 employees, there's a pretty unequivocal relationship where after COVID, they had a surge in hirings and job openings, and those have now all rolled over and drawn down quite strongly. And the drawdown is pretty dramatic, right, to the point where it's below trend. And I think this gives a better sense that for bigger businesses, they are starting to feel more profit margin pressures, and they are looking into doing more layoffs or hiring freezes. And it's actually visible in the aggregate data. But it just so happens that the micro businesses are still, you know, lacking workers or having big skill mismatch issues. And so they're the ones that's really propping up the data. So, you know, just looking at overall job openings or overall hires might be giving too a simplistic a picture of what's going on. You know, presumably micro businesses, smaller jobs tend to be less well paid. And, you know, that might also explain why, you know, you have a lot of these stories about multiple, you know, Americans having two, even three jobs, you know, that people can find a job, but they're not particularly happy with their personal finance situation. So I think breaking it out by micro business and the rest gives a much clearer sense of what's actually going on in the U.S. labor market.
Tell me about earnings per share forecasts on page 6.
You know, historically, there's a pretty good correlation between job openings data and the kind of forecast earnings data. And again, this is somewhat intuitive because, you know, if companies were feeling more optimistic about making money, then presumably they will want to take on more workers. And then, you know, they would obviously advertise for more jobs. And what's very interesting right now is there's been a pretty clear break down in that data where job openings are down a decent amount, but forecast earnings are still very strong. And this is a pattern that actually, you know, even if you break out the AI and tech pieces and just look at non-tech, more traditional businesses, it still does hold. And there's still a bit of a, you know, obviously non-tech EPS is coming down, but there's still a bit of a gap there. So, you know, these are hinting at the fact that earnings estimates are quite optimistic and there may be downside risks where, again, these earnings forecasts are probably somewhat linked to nominal GDP and the sense that, you know, fiscal's there, that economy is doing fine. But there are a lot of these kind of under the hood signs that whether it's to do with labor, layoffs, or indeed the kind of lagged effect of previous rate hikes, they are starting to come through. So I think that's where we try to just show this gap, which does warn that to be optimistic on equities here, you really, you know, you can't really rely on the earnings growth necessarily coming through. It's probably much more of a bet that, you know, we're going to get a bunch of cuts and a sustained re-rating rather than earnings growth matching these very elevated estimates.
Let's talk pricing power on page 8.
Yeah, so this is actually really interesting. I'm not sure if we talked about it last time, but we wanted a way to quantify how much pricing power U.S. businesses had, because obviously this is being a pretty key topic in terms of, you know, whether you want to call it greedflation or you know, just the drivers of inflation in the post-COVID environment. But basically, a lot of the work we've done has been inspired by the kind of original work that, you know, Isabella Weber did on greedflation. You know, we looked at a lot of her methodologies. And essentially, you know, the TLDR takeaway is that in aggregate, U.S. corporates don't really have pricing power anymore. Their ability to pass on costs are much lower today. So if their ability to pass on costs are much lower, then that probably explains why, you know, you're starting to see a bit more margin pressure, you know, a bit more news around layoffs picking up and so forth. So it's just like a confirming factor, because obviously if corporates have pricing power in aggregate, then they're able to pass costs on. But this effect has kind of started dying away a little bit.
Let's move on to inflation leading indicators. I should mention for our listeners' benefit that this was recorded just before the CPI data came out this week. So Tiana and I don't know what the data is yet. What's going on with respect to page 9 in the charts here on inflation leading indicators starting to bottom?
Yeah, so first of all, obviously, I have to acknowledge that the trailing inflation data has been pretty disinflationary. And I think the narrative has broadly come around to the disinflation story. And obviously, with the shelter CPI being such a big piece of the basket and shelter CPI having a lot of distortions coming out, that is going to go lower, right? So I think, you know, the data probably isn't going to be a shock in terms of upside surprise immediately. But a lot of the longer term leading relationships have started bottoming. And so it kind of suggests that as we go towards the second half of this year, inflation risk might start being more biased to the upside again. There's some very interesting relationships, such as, you know, the relationship between savings deposits and the median CPI, where, again, you know, it's hard to have it both ways, right? Like, if we're going to get a soft landing where the U.S. consumer remains super strong and they keep drawing down savings, then typically that means they're in the mood to spend. And typically, when they're in the mood to spend and savings get drawn down, that does actually lead to more inflationary pressures. So I don't think it's necessarily a massive problem right now, but it does kind of suggest this general consensus view that's already priced into kind of fixed income markets that the Fed needs to cut a lot, that we're going to be below target. It seems a little bit optimistic based on the kind of bottoming leading data. And even when we break things out, for example, we have lead indicators for all of the kind of top economies around the world, so essentially the top 30. And then we can take all the inputs into those models and build simple diffusion or breadth charts for those as well. And that's kind of the top right chart here on slide 9. And again, you know, the majority of inflation inputs are actually starting to rise again quarter on quarter. So there's various things that suggest that the market seems very complacent on the kind of disinflation narrative, and that lead indicators starting to suggest that we might start to see more of an upside surprise there.
Moving on to slide 10, we've got headwinds in liquidity.
So I think, you know, we will characterize it as more of a moderate headwind in terms of the level effect. So, you know, we did a ton of work last year on trying to understand and reconcile all the different narratives and metrics out there on liquidity, right? You know, obviously, some people look at Fed balance sheet, TGA, RRP, you know, you can look at yield curve, credit spreads, M2. And, you know, we wanted a way to generalize everything into like a kind of a more holistic framework. And what we came up with was actually heavily inspired by Perry Merling's work on the hierarchy of money and essentially using that to quantify liquidity. You can think of it a little bit like how a PE ratio is like a measure of the margin of safety in equities, right? Where the amount of earnings you have supports the market cap of equities. So the analogy to liquidity is how much kind of money have you created up and down the hierarchy of money to ultimately support asset prices. And so on these measures, what we're seeing is that, you know, the market cap of asset prices actually now are pretty high relative to kind of the amount of money that has been created, especially after the rally last year. So that's what's kind of suggesting more of a moderate headwind right now. So, you know, the margin of safety embedded in the monetary system is sort of a bit less than last year.
Let's move on to page 11 and volatility.
Yeah, so there's some extremely weird behavior within the vol markets. And in particular, what we highlighted here is that implied correlations are extremely low for the S&P 500 right now. And you can see historically, these things tend to be pretty correlated to actual realized pairwise correlations. I think this is a function of a lot of dispersion trades, you know, where people are selling index vol to buy single stock vol and trying to monetize that gap. But if you can just eyeball the charts, right, where implied correlation is such a low level that if for whatever reason something happens, to cause the unwind of these dispersion trades, the index vol is going higher. And indeed, index volatility has been realized. You know, obviously, it's been realizing low, but even relative to the realized levels, it's starting to look cheap. And so to us, it's a pretty interesting time to look at different long volatility expressions, just to express some of our underlying theme. So I think that was just a very interesting, maybe less followed market that's really at very extreme levels right now.
Let's move on to page 12 and where the value is in fixed income.
I think to us, you know, when you look at US treasuries and nominals, you know, it's not hugely compelling either way. Obviously, nominal fixed income will work if we get the hard landing. But I think the relative value is very much in TIPS, so, you know, betting on real yields going lower, and in mortgage-backed securities, in particular agency mortgage-backed, where you get a pretty decent pickup, where spreads are a lot wider versus, say, IG corporate credit. So those are where we see the kind of buckets of value and where we would be tilting fixed income allocations. This software trade, I mean, the market's actually moved a pretty big amount already, but the idea is that I think this year there's going to be opportunities to trade the short-term interest rate markets both ways, where, you know, as we try to price in too many cuts, it's a fade. But now that as we start taking cuts out, you know, ultimately that's an opportunity to bet on more hikes going in. Realistically, given the overall data, the market probably can't really price less than 3 cuts for the Fed, right? That's kind of where, you know, the Fed themselves have said they want to be, right? But we always need to price some risk that they cut more because something breaks. Or, you know, there's a delayed effect from the previous kind of issues, you know, previous rate hikes and so forth. So I think it's just a case of that's the range. Right now, we came into the year shorting software futures, but that's actually removed a decent amount. So I think it's a case of just checking the levels. But this is also a very cute environment to look at various things like put flies to do these kind of trade expressions where you can really level up your payoff, but with capped downside risk. So that was really the key point of that chart.
Let's move on to page 13, China and FX upside.
Yeah, so I think it's a dollar CNH upside still. So obviously, we kind of have to park a little bit when the government steps in to intervene. But, you know, on most of our longer term 12 months ahead macro FX models, you know, where it's basically some version of Mundell-Fleming, plus we use some gradient boosting to kind of learn nonlinear behaviors in FX markets. But basically, everything's pointing to dollar CNH going higher. And it's actually aligning with a bunch of our tactical indicators as well. So, and you're also starting to see this in, you know, the PBOC starting to increase its balance sheet, trying to intervene a bit more. So broadly speaking, the trading bias remains dollar CNH upside until, you know, there's some signs that they really want to intervene, right? But to me, the really cute trade, and as we talked about even in the beginning of the call, is you want to have probably own like call spreads on dollar CNH, and then also own some kind of capped upside on Chinese equities, right? Like, so, you know, I talked about the 1x2s earlier, and having both legs independently could actually be really cute this year, because normally they shouldn't be correlated as well, right? Normally, like if Chinese equities rally, it's because people think the economy is doing better, so the RMB actually strengthens. And obviously, it could happen if they do like a ton of repatriation of dollar assets. But this time around, it feels like the underlying problems are still too structural in the Chinese economy. It's still pushing on a string. They're going to ease policy. It might not work. And so you're going to have this depreciation pressure in RMB. But at the same time, you know, the equities are so bombed out. You know, we had all these LPPL crash climaxes that, again, if you have a capped downside weight to bet on the upside, you know, it could be really attractive. So that's kind of how it's lining up right now.
Let's move on to page 14 and your global equity allocation tables.
So this is more for like a slightly longer term asset allocator point of view. So, you know, I think to us, what we consider our kind of most unique, most powerful, for lack of a better word, alpha factors would be on crowding and capital cycle. So capital cycle really works on more of a 3 to 5 year forward period. But, you know, to us, capital cycle is like the fundamentals of how capitalism works, right? It's the quantification of capitalism in a way. Like money has to go from like the lowest marginal use to the highest marginal use over kind of a 3 to 5 year period, because there's obviously lots of investors, lots of smart people trying to figure out where to allocate capital. So capital cycle to us is for us tracking where the relative marginal returns are, you know, what's previous investment and what is future profit potential. But at the same time, because these are kind of 3 to 5 year forward models, the problem is obviously in the short run, we all, you know, have mark-to-market pressures and, you know, we have to manage the risk. And this is where the crowding piece comes in. So we can quantify crowding using like a lot of data on consensus estimates and portfolio holdings from companies that need to disclose it. But we'll also do some modeling around, you know, how much of the price action is due to kind of speculative flows versus patient money flows, and ultimately turn these into a metric. So to us, the most attractive equity allocations are usually, you know, very capital scarce areas of the market, i.e. big future profit potential, but that have low crowding today. And, you know, this is still pointing us towards, you know, things like gold miners, oil and gas, pockets of EM, LATAM, and so forth. So those are kind of our most favored areas. China technically fits as well, but obviously in China's case, I think it's up to the individual to decide, can they accept the political risk, you know, all the things around return of capital versus return on capital. So, you know, that's kind of how we think about it.
And let's move on to page 15, sector allocation.
Yeah, so this is, apply a very similar framework where we'll look at capital cycle, look at crowding and so forth. But on a sector level, you also tend to pick up on some pretty big divergences on kind of the implicit interest rate exposure as well. So, you know, we'll calculate kind of equity duration for different sectors and different stocks. This is kind of an analogous concept to bond market duration, except it's obviously for equities, right? Where you get a sense of the rate exposure. So in an environment like today's where it's a question of how much the Fed's going to cut, you know, ideally first you want capital scarce sectors that have high future profit potential, but that actually have very high duration, so they benefit from rate cuts. And that naturally leads us to energy staples and actually materials right now. We'll also do some comparative analysis on kind of sector high yield spreads versus the earnings yield. So again, usually, you know, if the spread is high versus earnings yield, you know, you're probably better. It tells you like the credit is a bit more attractive. And obviously vice versa, if your earnings yield is high, but your spread is low, they kind of suggest that equities are a bit more attractive. So as of right now, again, it's saying for energy, equities make more sense. But for some of the kind of more tech healthcare names, to the extent that the credit is available, you know, the credit actually looks a bit cheaper relative to equities right now.
Tian, as that wraps up the slide deck, I want to ask you a few questions about things I've been thinking about. One of them is this whole question of breadth in the market. So many people have commented on this. It seems so easy to see that, oh boy, you know, major breadth divergence, clearly it's got to be a top. But wait a minute, we've had the breadth divergence for, I don't know, months now, it feels like. It hasn't topped yet, or the topping market keeps going up. What's the story here?
Yeah, so we've actually done some work on kind of historical quote-unquote bubbles and what kind of behavior you typically see at the end. And so narrowing breadth is merely one of the signals, but as you say, right, by itself, it might not necessarily be that meaningful. So if you look at all the kind of major tops, right, you know, going back to 1929, the Nifty 50 top, yes, you do have very narrow pockets of leadership that way outperform kind of the median stock. But then you also need kind of the median stock to actually go sideways and even start falling. And then you need monetary tightening, right? Those are typically like the actual ingredients that's, you know, preceded those tops. So in a way, if you consider all three, then, you know, 2022 was kind of more of that setup, right? Where you had the monetary tightening into kind of these tech leaders. Whereas today, if all the central banks are going to start easing, then you don't necessarily have that tightening liquidity catalyst that has been, you know, observed at least at historical bubble tops. And, you know, in a way, a lot of the dynamics in the post-COVID environment is tricky, right? Because these big quantum magnificent seven or six these days, like, you know, they have very good balance sheets. You know, they can raise financing much cheaper than your average business, right? Issue IG debt at like low single digits, right? They're obviously less subject to kind of some of the labor cost pressures because, you know, everyone's been studying to be a computer scientist for 20 years, right? They're not struggling to find workers. So in a way, they're also less subject to problems and they had a lot of fat to cut. So I think, yeah, from a kind of macro big cycle point of view, without monetary tightening, typically those don't burst these kind of narrow breath bubbles. You know, obviously the price action does tell you there's a lot of belief in how game-changing, you know, a lot of these new AI technologies are. And, you know, that seems to become the overwhelming narrative, and that ultimately is going to lead to a lot of disinflation as well. And I think that's where potentially this excitement isn't necessarily fully showing up, right? I think we did a lot of work before on, you know, what we call the age of scarcity thesis, where, yes, we get that this is clearly game-changing technology. Ultimately, it could help change the world. But at the same time, some of the other factors like monetary and fiscal policy coordination, right, which has historically been pretty inflationary, you know, things like geopolitical tensions, the need to start building different kind of supply chains, right? Like, you know, geopolitically, we're in an environment of a focus on national security over efficiency more, right? So there's other factors that might limit just how powerful these AI technologies are and how disinflationary they are. So to me, that's a more interesting angle. Whereas on the bubble front specifically, yeah, there might be trading opportunities, but from a historical end of bubble point of view, without the monetary tightening, it's not that common for these things to just burst on their own.
Tian, something a lot of people think is going to define this entire year is the U.S. elections. But boy, I think this is complicated because so many people seem to be assuming, okay, a lot of people want to keep Trump out of office, so therefore the Fed's just going to goose the market, you know, all the way to the election. Well, wait a minute. What if they figure out how to keep him out of office and get him off the ballot well before the election? You know, maybe that changes the thesis. What do you see here? And it seems to me like this is a year that, you know, could be a setup to take a few unexpected turns. What do you see on the horizon?
You know, obviously, we don't claim to be political experts, but one thing we do try and do is really think from first principles on what can be modeled and what data is available. So I think on the political front, obviously we can all look at like polling data, you know, there's betting markets, but a framework we actually really like as something a bit additive is essentially this thing called Keys to the White House. That was Professor Lichtman, who's like a politics professor, and he's been, you know, quite famously associated with this for a while, where the key is that he says you should think about elections and not focus too much on the personalities and the specifics involved. Elections tend to be referendums on the past. So essentially, you can group elections into either continuation or change. So if on the whole, people are happy with the past 4 years, people will vote for continuation. And if people are not happy with the past 4 years, they'll vote for change. And so you can ask a bunch of kind of simple checklist type questions to figure out if people are happy or not. And so, you know, when you kind of follow through his frame, you know, it's stuff like, you know, has GDP per capita gone up, right? Has there been, you know, social unrest? You know, there's questions like that, you know, what happened in the midterms. But essentially right now it is pretty much a knife's edge where it actually predicts a change election. But obviously, you know, these things can change as we get towards November. But right now, I think on the framework, in our interpretation, it is predicting just a change election, which would actually mean the Democrats lose. But obviously we'll see as we get a bit closer to it. So that's like at least a bit of an additive, a different kind of framework to look at it. And obviously if it's a change election, those are usually quite important because market leadership tends to change afterwards. That's fairly intuitive, right? Like when you get a change election and someone new comes in, they enact like a big change in policy. And, you know, there's vivid examples from Reagan doing deregulation to maybe, you know, Obamacare. So when these things happen, you do get changes in leadership. And that's probably the main thing to think about, that previous winners might not continue outperforming to the same extent in a change election. But obviously, if it's a continuation election, then you know, generally the previous patterns carry on.
Tian, I can't thank you enough for a terrific interview. But before I let you go, tell us a little bit more about what you do at Variant Perception. Your firm is particularly well known for its work on leading indicators. Tell us about what services you offer and how people can follow your work.
Yeah, so obviously the website, variantperception.com. I think for us, we basically work with three main types of institutional investors. So the first is probably more of a multi-asset portfolio manager CIO type. So, you know, those are probably ongoing discussions, big picture macro stories, you know, very similar to our discussion today. I think the second type we work with is more of a global macro kind of hedge fund PM. So I think that's a lot more specific to market timing, LPPL signals, you know, policy regime models and trade structuring. And then the third type is really actually bottom-up single stock investors, where again, the work we do on crowding, capital cycle, equity factors, and so forth, and applying to single stocks can be a potentially additive risk management tool for them. So that's a little bit how we think about the client types and how our models apply to each one. And obviously, you know, we maintain a Twitter and some social media followings if you want to see some of the content we put out there, you know, Variant Perception on all the usual platforms.
Patrick Ceresna, Nick Galarnik, and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, great interview with Tian. Now joining us again in the post-game segment is Nick Galarnik. Now let's get to that chart deck. Listeners, you're going to find the download link for the post-game chart deck in your Research Roundup email. If you don't have a Research Roundup email, that means you have not yet registered at macrovoices.com. Just go to our homepage, macrovoices.com, and click on the red button over Tian's picture saying, looking for the downloads. Now, Eric, let's cover crude oil, starting with the EIA inventory.
EIA printed an utterly massive build of 12 million barrels of crude oil, Cushing, Oklahoma building 710,000 barrels, but that was offset by big drawdowns on finished products, with gasoline drawing down 3.7 million barrels and distillates drawing down 1.9 million barrels for a net petroleum build of 6.4 million barrels. U.S. production held steady at 13.3 million barrels. Looking at the April futures contract chart, the steep sell-off on Wednesday and reaction to that massive inventory build seems to suggest that this rally failed exactly where it did last time at the 34-week moving average. And at first glance, that seems to suggest, well, maybe we're headed back down to test the lows again. But I don't think so. The front-of-curve time spreads tend to be a much stronger indication of what the smartest professional oil traders think than the flat price chart is. And Wednesday was an extraordinary day in the sense that even in the face of that sharp sell-off on flat price, it still didn't pull the prompt spread back into contango, nor did it collapse the subsequent spreads nearly as much as one would expect given the magnitude of the flat price sell-off. This tells me that the dumb money panicked and sold on the massive inventory build, thinking it would surely end the rally. But the smartest money, the professionals who trade the spreads rather than the front month, seem to disagree with them. So my guess is that this rally is set to resume as soon as the market shrugs off and digests that big inventory build. And a daily close over $79, that's the 34-week moving average where the last two rallies failed, would be a bullish signal suggesting that that rally is set to continue much higher.
Now, Eric, for me, for the last month, we've been seeing a pattern of accumulation in oil. We obviously, through the months of October, November, going into December, we're in an aggressive distribution cycle in oil that saw it shave it off almost $20 from top to the bottom. But we've seen a scenario where throughout late December into January, every dip was being bought. You know, there would be $3 down days and immediately reversing back up. And we see a lot of structural things like gasoline futures doing incredibly well in terms of starting to break out of multi-month ranges. A lot of these things are showing a more accumulative price action, which is a good base from which some sort of short-term rallies can begin. Now, we have had Anas on the show suggesting that oil has no big bull catalyst this year, and I'm not against that view, but I also don't think there's much stopping oil from trading towards the top end of last year's ranges in, you know, to the mid 80s to even mid 90s before coming right back down. It's just a trade range kind of price action. So in my mind, this dip that's coming in here in oil is really interesting, because if we can hold above the 50-day and hold the retracement zones in the $75 area and stay in this range, that might set up for that $79 breakout. And I would not be shocked if that sent us into the $80 to $85 range on the upside of oil. So I think looking for the bull breakout is something that's on my mind. Though I want to move on here to equities and get Nick involved in the conversation. Now, Nick, before we talk the bigger picture of these charts, let's start off with just looking at what levels you're watching.
Yeah, Patrick. So right now the SPX is sitting at a spot price of approximately 5,000, which is a key level. There's a call wall above at 5,100 and a put wall below at 4,800, which is near the previous all-time highs of 4,820. Now, the implied move for the March 15th monthly OPEX is plus minus 130 points. Therefore, the implied upper move is 5,130 and the implied move lower is 4,870. Key resistance right now above is at all-time highs at 50.50 approximately, and key support below is at 4,900 roughly. I'm inclined to think we see a move lower over the next few weeks, especially after tomorrow's monthly OPEX for February. As volatility picks up, we saw CPI come in a bit hotter than expected for January on Tuesday, and that caused us to have a move lower in markets, which were then bought up yesterday. But again, I think this will be very short-lived with earnings over now. Also keep in mind that we have the next FOMC meeting just after the March monthly OPEX on March 18th, 19th, I believe it is. So there should be volatility into that event as well. But my key levels right now are upside, obviously, all-time highs, 50-50. I think it's possible we push perhaps 5,100 at the highest point, but I do think we see some downside action toward 4,900. And if we get below that, a fast shot to 4,800.
Yeah, those are levels that I think make a lot of sense. But the real question to me, I kind of step back and try to understand what condition we're in here. So we have an incredibly overbought market. I mean, at this stage in 110 days or so, we've traveled almost 1,000 S&P points from a trough to peak. And that is a very overbought condition and the typical length of rallies. So the way I look at this is that this is a very mature market that typically pauses and mean reverts. It doesn't have to be the big kahuna, the big bear market, but just rallies get checked and profit-taking cycles happen. But with that said, the prevailing trend is intact. Higher highs, higher lows, dips being bought, price action is accumulative. And so trying to short this market is fighting the prevailing trend. One of the things that I feel that needs to be watched over the next week is, when do we see this pattern change? When do we see the market fail to break to a higher high? When do we see a sell-off that doesn't get fully recovered and bought on dip quickly? When does the nature of the price action shift? And considering that we were gamma pinned throughout the week at this 5,000 level, I think watching early next week, whether or not a rally can stick, and more importantly, if we break below 4,900, are going to be the levels to watch. You were right about the 4,800 level. That's about where the 50-day moving average is, as well as the 50% retracement of the most recent rally. So if we did see some short-term highs, that would be a very reasonable one-week target for the downside. What levels are you watching on the NASDAQ?
So on the Qs right now, spot price is approximately 434. We have a call wall above at 440, also all-time highs, and a put wall below at 410, previous all-time highs. The implied move for the March 15th monthly OPEX is plus minus 16 points. Therefore, the upper implied move is 450 and the lower implied move is 418. Currently, resistance is above at all-time highs at 440, where the call wall resides, and key support is below at previous all-time highs at 410. Now, again, I'm inclined to think we see a decent pullback in some of these names. The way I'm kind of viewing these mega caps now, you know, Amazon in particular is, as a conglomerate, right? It has so many different businesses now that it's almost like buying an ETF in and of itself. However, there are names that I view as being very overvalued. Nvidia, for example, is now worth more than Google, which I view as being absolutely absurd. So their earnings coming up pretty soon. And once that happens, we may see, you know, a pop higher or a drop lower, perhaps. That will likely guide the market in tech another direction.
Yeah, the interesting thing there, Nick, is that we're starting to see fewer and fewer of the Mag 7s really leading the way. Now, of course, Nvidia is ripping very strongly, but you see stocks like Tesla and Apple really being quite sluggish in their price action. And so it's almost like the generals that were leading this bull market, and slowly some of these generals are being shot, and there's fewer and fewer that are kind of pushing things forward. And we'll see whether or not the other ones can keep the momentum going to allow this market to still make a higher high. Wanted to touch on volatility. Yesterday, we saw, or at least on the CPI day, we had that big spike in the VIX hitting the 18 handle, at least on an intraday basis. And was the first kind of boogeyman moment from volatility spikes that we've seen in 3 months. Now, obviously, we've given it right back. We're back down to the 14 handle. But what I'm really going to be curious about now is, will we see new sustained higher levels of volatility, or will this get right back down to the low teens where we've been going, and that this was just a fake out? With this kind of a move, if we see more sustained periods above 15, is going to be signaling to me that there's an appetite for hedging, and that low vol, low short gamma kind of condition is maybe unwinding a little bit. What's your take on the VIX?
So with the VIX right now at around a 14 level, we expect to see around 0.8% moves top to bottom intraday on SPX. On Tuesday, when we declined from that, you know, previous day of all-time highs on Monday, from 50, 48 or so, all the way down to 49.20 on Tuesday, we saw something very interesting happen. So call selling actually picked up heavily on the VIX because we had VIXpiration yesterday. And also put selling on SPX occurred greatly at 49.20 as well. So that caused that short-term rally on Tuesday off that bottom. You know, we moved about 35 points or so in the span of less than an hour from 49.20 all the way up to a closing price of 49.55 or so. So right now we're seeing a lot of volatility selling still occurring as we spike up. So these small spikes are kind of being beaten down by volatility sellers. However, that doesn't necessarily forebode that we will keep volatility suppressed. We may expand beyond what's expected, and that can actually cause a lot more market pain and a lot more volatility, because as short option sellers are pushed to cover their positions, that will cause a lot of movement in either direction. So anyways, moving on to page 7, we have the US dollar index. What are your thoughts here?
I'm going to go out on a limb here and say that I think the single most important issue in finance in 2024 is going to be figuring out the Fed's true intentions in this election year. When the long-awaited Fed pivot finally came, it was painfully clear that they had been influenced by someone or something. Just a week earlier, Jay Powell had said almost the opposite. Then suddenly it changed. And then when the dot plot predicted 3 rate cuts starting later this year, the market instantaneously jumped to the conclusion that they were just downplaying their real intentions, so markets began discounting 6 or 7 rate cuts starting in March. I said at the time that the market was getting ahead of itself. Well, the rubber just hit the road in the form of Tuesday's CPI print coming in hot. That's the exact trigger that Jay Powell has said in the past would cause the Fed to pause and maybe even further delay any rate cutting. And who knows, maybe even move towards some actual monetary tightening in order to fight inflation that looks like it's rearing its ugly head again and maybe isn't quite as under control as everyone was assuming. Of course, then again, it was not that big of a miss, only 0.1% on the CPI that got everybody so upset about the hot print. So maybe it's not a big deal. But hang on a second. Our good friend Jim Bianco at Bianco Research has a tweet thread out this week saying Jim thinks that inflation has just bottomed and will increase from here. So I think Jay Powell is perhaps about to be tested. I predict that he knows in his heart of hearts that if inflation picks back up, the Fed should abandon its cut plans and make a clear announcement to the market that the cuts are coming off the table because the data has changed. But that would likely be political suicide for Jay Powell in this election year. My point is simply that it's not possible for us to know how the Fed will react to data that should cause them to resume tightening until that data actually hits the tape and they're forced to make that decision. And I have a nagging feeling that that's coming soon. So where the dollar, gold, and most other asset classes go from here is going to depend on the extent to which the Fed is political versus staying true to its mission of fighting inflation, which would suggest abandoning the rate cuts if inflation has in fact bottomed and is about to move higher, as Jim Bianco is suggesting. Patrick and I both said last week that if the Dixie moved over 104.5, that would be the signal that a new move higher on the dollar index is upon us. Now, that's exactly what happened on Tuesday in reaction to the hot CPI print. But look, that was a knee-jerk reaction to an unexpected surprise in data. So there's room for it to reverse back to the downside if the market thinks that the data was wrong. In other words, if the market thinks that CPI isn't really bottoming and isn't about to move higher. But there's also room for a move higher to accelerate quickly if the market comes around to Jim Bianco's view that inflation perhaps has already bottomed and is about to move much higher. Unless, that is, inflation is headed higher, but the Fed is going to cut anyway in order to placate the White House. And of course, that would cause inflation to accelerate even more. My real point is that politics, more than market fundamentals, are going to drive the dollar, and we don't yet know what Jay Powell is made of when push comes to shove, and he is perhaps about to be forced to choose between political pressures and doing what he knows the Fed should do in reaction to changing data. If it's changing, which isn't completely clear quite yet. Right now, we're in the moment of suspended animation as the market tries to digest the CPI print and decide what it means and what comes next. I expect the Dixie to either retrace hard to the downside if the market decides to write off the CPI print as an anomaly, or else accelerate quickly to the upside if the market comes around to Jim Bianco's view that inflation has already bottomed and is starting to move higher. This will happen quickly. If we close on Friday with the Dixie over 105, it's probably the beginning of a new move much higher, and we'll have to reevaluate everything at that point. But let's not write off the possibility of a downside retracement. This is time to listen very carefully to messaging from the Fed for cues as to how they intend to navigate what could be a fierce battle between heeding White House demands that they're theoretically immune from versus doing what they've actually been tasked with doing.
Eric, I get it with the political risks and elections coming in being a big variable. But to me, I look at it even a little bit bigger picture, because what is really driving the U.S. dollar strength? And what we see is a lot of the big economies around the world outside of the U.S. are very weak. We just saw a recession print in Japan. We saw a recession print in the U.K. and the European economy is weaker than the U.S. economy. And so the U.S. is the cleaner, dirty shirt in this scenario, which is causing flows and money is coming into the United States based on a stronger economy. This is keeping that U.S. dollar strong. I mean, the U.S. dollar yen is now above the 150 level, retesting those October, November highs. And so while there are the political drivers and the Fed, the interesting part is, will the U.S. dollar just simply play the global safe haven asset? And what are the intermarket implications for that? I look at this break of the 104.5 level as significant, and it'll be really interesting to see whether or not the U.S. dollar builds on that or whether it fades. I still think generally the U.S. dollar has lots of room to be strong throughout the first half of the year.
And moving on to pages 8 and 9, Eric, you wanted to add in a couple of gold charts here. I'm interested in hearing your thoughts.
There can be no doubt that the hot CPI print on Tuesday was the cause of the big down week on gold. As I've said so many times before, I think 2024 is likely to be the year that gold will break out to new all-time highs. But it's all about the dollar and the timing of the Fed cuts. And now we're seeing signs that inflation may be bottoming and that this might not be the last hotter than expected inflation print. We don't know that conclusively yet, nor do we know whether the Fed will respond by tightening or if they'll stay the course on rate cuts just for political reasons in an election year. The point is, the possible outcomes for gold are all over the map on a fundamental analysis level. Inflation getting worse from here, but the Fed cutting anyway for the sake of appeasing the White House, is the most bullish scenario imaginable for gold. But if inflation starting to return causes the Fed to publicly announce an intention to change course on monetary policy and abandon its plans to cut rates, well, that would suggest that we've got a horribly bearish outcome ahead of us for gold. And the technical signal is even more confused. I've included two separate gold charts in this week's slide deck. The first is the continuous futures contract chart, which really doesn't look all that bad considering that we're speaking in the wake of an unexpectedly hot CPI print. The market is still above both the 100 and 200-day moving averages on that chart. The 200-day is the amber line, and its label is obscured on this chart by the volume-weighted moving average at the same level, which is covering over the label on the 200-day. Both of them are at about 1980 on the price scale. This chart is showing a market that seems to be starting to bounce off its 100-day moving average with the slow stochastics bottoming at the same time. In other words, this chart could be showing the beginning of a price reversal, about to move the market back up and retrace higher. But when contango is steep in the futures market, the continuous and contract charts don't always tell the same story. And in such cases, most futures traders will tell you that the front month contract chart will give the better technical analysis cues. So let's also look at the second gold chart in the deck, which is the April delivery contract chart. This chart looks absolutely dreadful. Tuesday's move in reaction to CPI decisively took out both the 100 and 200-day moving averages to the downside, leaving no obvious support immediately below the market. That could spell the beginning of an ominous move much lower, which would be entirely consistent with a fundamental view that inflation has already bottomed and the Fed is about to abandon its rate-cutting plans. Another $100 of downside wouldn't be at all out of the question in that scenario. So once again, the signals are numerous and conflicting. If you're still convinced that the big theme of 2024 in terms of monetary policy will be a program of rate cuts from the Fed, then the continuation chart will rationalize that view for you, and it looks like this is actually a buy here because, well, we're right at the bottom of the horizontal consolidation range, having just retested the January swing low and almost retesting the December swing low. But if the Fed is about to abandon its rate-cutting plans because inflation isn't really under control after all, well, then in that case, the usually more reliable contract chart is showing you a breakdown below support that could be just the beginning of a big price move much lower. I don't know which it is, nor do I think anyone else does. It's not just a question of whether inflation is really under control. The bigger and more important question is whether the Fed would abandon its rate-cutting plans in that scenario, or if they would stay the course for the sake of keeping the economy and markets goosed up through the election season. And we won't know that answer until we see the Fed's next move.
Well, Eric, certainly if we see a scenario where the expectations of a first half of the year Fed interest rate cut and it gets pulled back and it's really a second half of the year story, that certainly is going to be a drag on gold, which was really, you know, had a very strong impulse based upon the idea that the easing cycle was imminent. With that said, of course, there is always room for gold to head down towards a dip toward 1950 or 1900, where it traded through much of last year. But it wouldn't change my bigger view that it's just one big buy on dip and that gold is going much higher. So the question now is really, do we go through some sort of a short-term pullback cycle where a one-month pullback of a $50 or $100 an ounce offers a much more compelling buying opportunity, let's say come April or May? It's certainly the thing that we are watching. On the short term, it's trading below its 50-day moving average. And so it is in some sort of a consolidation corrective mode. And so right now we have to respect that as the short term prevailing trend. Moving on, I wanted to just touch, though, on page 11 on the U.S. 10-year Treasury yield. And what we had was obviously a quick drop from 5% all the way down to 380 over the course of just several months in what was just an amazing bond rally. And we really spent the entire first 6 weeks of the year consolidating that in that trade range established between 4.25 to 380. And what we really saw here was a breakout, now consolidating at higher levels. So yields clearly have come under pressure and are pressing higher as inflation boogeyman starts to kind of rear its head here. The bigger question in my mind, is this sending the 10-year treasury yield back to October highs near 5%? And for me, I'm still a seller on that idea. While sure, inflation will reemerge and maybe it will be a little bit stronger than the disinflationary impulse that we've saw, but I don't think that that drives much higher inflation expectations that have already been in many ways priced in over the last 2-3 years. And so I don't think we're going back to 5%, but will it be a shocker to me if we print 440, 450 on the upside? Not really. So on the short term, yields may get a little pressure on that upside.
Folks, if you enjoy Patrick's chart decks, you can get them every single day of the week with a free trial of Big Picture Trading. The details are on the last pages of the slide deck, or just go to bigpicturetrading.com. Patrick, tell them what they can expect to find in this week's research roundup.
Well, in this week's research roundup, you're going to find the transcript for today's interview, as well as the slide deck that TN provided, including the chart book we just discussed here in the post game. We also included a number of links to articles that we found interesting, so you're going to find this and so much more in this week's research roundup.
Well, that does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners and are always looking for suggestions on how we can make this program even better. For those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com and we will consider it for our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account @macrovoices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter @EricSTownsend. That is Eric spelled with a K. And follow Patrick @PatrickSerezna. On behalf of Eric Townsend, Patrick Serezna, and myself, thanks for listening and see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly research roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.